Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, welcome to New Books in History. I'm Patrick Riley, a host on the channel. Today I'll be talking to historian Simon Balto about his new book, Occupied Territory, Policing Black Chicago from Red Summer to Black Power, out this year with UNC Press. Within its pages, Balto argues that the repressive urban policing in Chicago and other American cities cannot be understood without reference to local politics and struggles over city development. The national anti-crime legislation of the latter half of the 20th century was significant, but the roots of our present-day policing crisis, as Balto argues, run much deeper. The book contributes to our understanding of municipal governance, race, and social movements. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, welcome to New Books in History. I'm Patrick Riley. Today, we're talking to historian Simon Balto about his fascinating new book, Occupied Territory, Policing Black Chicago from Red Summer to Black Power. Thanks for joining me, Simon.
Thanks for having me.
Could you begin by telling listeners how you came to study history and specifically the topic of policing?
Sure. The question of how I came to study history is sort of, I don't know what the best word for it is, but it's a circuitous route to where I am. I got a bachelor's degree in history, but that was mostly because I sort of stumbled into it after trying a number of other majors. And I had no inclination when I graduated that I was going to end up going to graduate school. But I was working in Chicago for a year or two. I moved to Chicago after a couple years after my bachelor's. And I was just working as a cook. And once I kind of was trying to figure out what I wanted to do that didn't involve just working a line for the rest of my life, I decided that maybe I'd try graduate school. And so I had a particular passion in Black history when I was doing my undergraduate. And so I decided that I would maybe go do that. And so so I ended up going to graduate school really in a pretty unplanned way. I know a lot of, when I arrived at graduate school, I went to graduate school at my alma mater, University of Wisconsin. So I have all three of my degrees from that one institution. So I think I'm one of those cautionary tales about it's not a cautionary tale, I guess, but when I arrived at graduate school, I was made aware of the fact that the normal route is to apply to a bunch of different places and do a lot of research. And I had not done any of that. So I didn't necessarily feel all that prepared when I got there, but I was at least interested, which I think is a lot of the battle. So, I mean, that's how I ultimately ended up kind of where I am, was not in a particularly planned route, but that when I sort of look back on it, it makes a lot of sense to me. With the benefit of hindsight. In terms of my actual idea for studying policing, so I came to graduate school with this really as my second idea. First idea, so I'd been living in Chicago, as I said before, I went to graduate school. And part of what I was really interested in, when I was living in Chicago, was Fred Hampton and the Illinois Black Panthers. And so when I arrived at graduate school in Madison, I was talking to people who were advising me, and I don't even recall exactly how this conversation unfolded, but basically they kind of redirected me away from doing that. And so they were like, what else are you interested in? And so part of what I was interested in was that when I was living in Chicago, I walked a ton, and I lived up in Rogers Park, but I spent time downtown. I spent time on the South Side. I spent some time on the West Side. And I was really interested in just how different the operations of various municipal operations, how much it differed from place to place throughout the city. So like we think of a city as like a single ecosystem, but why did it seem that when it comes to things like the police force, why they seem to operate in fundamentally different ways as they're policing different cities from, say, the Loop to, you know, North Lawndale to Hyde Park and so on and so forth. So, you know, that was kind of my second pitch to my advisors, was to study the history of policing in Black Chicago and try to figure out why it was that policing looked so different from neighborhood to neighborhood within the city. And so that was ultimately where I landed. And this was, you know, this was back in 2008. So it was before, you know, before Black Lives Matter, before Ferguson, so on and so forth. So it was kind of odd to be in the middle of studying all these things in a historical perspective over the past few years. I mean, it's been useful and helpful in the sense that I feel like I have something to contribute in terms of being able to explain some of what's happened, and also to be able to amplify Black voices that have for generations been saying these things about the police. It's just that, you know, not as many people have been listening. So yeah, so it was, again, just as my route to being a historian was a little bit circuitous, I think my route to my subject matter for the book was a little circuitous as well.
That's great. So in the first few pages of the book, you mentioned that this story you tell was an intensely local one.
Sure.
Can you talk about why it's important that you ground your book like that relative to the books about policing and prisons that have been written already?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, just thinking historiographically a bit, and it's not even just historiographically, because so much of the relevant literature is coming from other disciplines, coming from, you know, criminologists and sociologists and so on. But one of the things that actually drove me to study this subject through the chronology that I did, which is 1919 to the 1970s, is that so much of the literature that we have about things like mass incarceration, policing, and prisons, it's all tethered to like the 1960s and onward, and in some cases, really to the 1980s and onward. And that makes sense to some degree because when we think about the prison boom in America, you know, I mean, that's when the 1980s is when that really takes off in a profound way. But so much of the literature seemed to kind of suggest that all of these things were products of federal policy choices made by people like Lyndon Johnson with the war on crime, people like Nixon and Reagan with their respective war on drugs and so on. And that didn't strike me as really fully making sense within the context of understanding how cities work and how, you know, how local context does matter. And so I wanted to kind of dig deeper into, well, how did policing change, you know, over time? And in respect to different, you know, political and social dynamics, you know, there's really the best way to do that is to study a particular place, you know, because, I mean, when you think about an institution like the police, I mean, we can talk about how the federal government incentivizes certain policing practices and so on. But the reality is that, like, the vast majority of funding for the police comes locally. The vast majority of police policy is crafted locally. People experience the police not as some sort of federal agent, but as local agents and so on. So it was primarily driven in some senses by just not fully buying the narrative that existed both in the scholarly and public domains. And so to study the situation locally kind of challenges in pretty fundamental ways, I think, a lot of the narrative that we have about the police, in particular about the police becoming hyper-aggressive and really, you know, having this incredibly outsized power that is somehow forged in the aftermath of 1965 and the passage of the war on crime. The reality is that by 1965, the police in places like Chicago were really well-funded, had an incredible amount of power, had robust support from both political parties. And so when you actually study locally, that narrative about the criminal justice system in a lot of ways is fundamentally challenged in ways that I think are really important.
I agree. I think you do a good job of kind of highlighting how, contrary to a lot of that literature, police aren't just an empty vessel waiting to be filled with federal policy.
Right.
And then they just go and do whatever that prescribes. Right. So I'll move to the first chapter of the book, which addresses the 1919 riots, mm-hmm. which has received a lot of press lately because of the 100 year anniversary. Could you briefly outline the riot for people who don't know, and then also describe the relationship between white ethnic gangs, aldermanic patronage, and how that basically resulted in impunity for white rioters?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, I mean, we're commemorating the 100 year anniversary of Chicago's race riots as we speak. So, you know, they begin on July 27, 1919 with the murder of a black boy by a white man on the beach on the south side. And then when black folks call for his arrest, they approach a white police officer and ask for this murderer to be arrested, and the police officer refuses. And black people obviously take umbrage with that, and that's sort of the context in which the riot explodes. There's obviously, for years before that, there had been, you know, it had been simmering. So, you know, as a historian, I'm not inclined to say that something was inevitable, but it was likely that something, you know, that violence was going to explode at some point over something. And it happened to be July 27th, 1919. So 38 people are killed in that riot. It lasts almost a week. Thousands of homes are damaged or completely destroyed. Hundreds of people are arrested, millions of dollars of property damage, and so on. One of the key stories, I think, in terms of the riot, at least in terms of understanding and thinking about law enforcement, in terms of thinking about whiteness, is that you have the key aggressors in the riot are really, in a lot of ways, these white ethnic gangs that you describe. A lot of Italian young men, especially, are involved in the rioting as really, really aggressor collectives. Essentially, Richard Daley, who goes on to become mayor, was a member of one of these. He never really wanted to publicly comment about his involvement or non involvement in the riots, but he was certainly likely that he was a member. One of the reasons that they can do the things that they do in terms of just marauding through the South Side, beating black people, killing black people, is because they are also working as kind of political foot soldiers for powerful politicians in Chicago. And so if you connect the dots, the police at this point in time, a lot of police officers owe their livelihoods to politicians. Because Chicago is so corrupt and it's so embedded in the machine system, both the Republican and Democratic parties. This is before the Democratic Party assumes supremacy in the city. But both the Republican Party and Democratic Party have their own party machinery that's heavily wedded to patronage. And so the way that a lot of cops get their jobs is by knowing the right people. And so they literally owe their livelihood to those politicians. So you have politicians who are very close with these youth gangs. You have police officers who owe their careers to these politicians. And so when these youth groups are out committing extraordinary acts of violence and extraordinary acts of illegality, the police are either explicitly told in some cases, or at least know the writing on the wall, that if they go after these youth groups, these white youth groups, that they risk retribution from their political overlords, for lack of a better word. And so what ends up unfolding throughout the course of the riot is that even though black people are wildly disproportionate, the victims of white violence, as opposed to white victims of black violence, that the police are arresting far, far, far more black folks than whites. It's basically an inverse relationship to reality. It's essentially what they do. And so, you know, and people at the time are actually commenting on this in ways that are really fascinating, because, you know, when we think about, you know, these issues of disproportionality and inequity within the law enforcement system now, people during 1919, so, you know, like grand juries in the aftermath of the riot who are convened to, you know, to to be juries for these cases of people involved in the riot. One of the grand juries, which is comprised entirely of white people, goes on strike because they see racism at play, because they say, how are you bringing so many black people before us when they were the primary victims of this violence? So you actually have in 1919, you know, some people who are offering pretty sophisticated analyses and protests of systematic racism within the criminal justice system. But, you know, that doesn't translate to any meaningful reform.
That protest is shocking.
Yeah.
I think the first chapter is obviously an important one in which you outline kind of two prongs of police repression, one of which is anti-black violence, which is kind of the more obvious one. And then another one that isn't perhaps talked as much about, but that you hinted at, which is discriminatory neglect.
Mm-hmm.
I think you do a really good job of sprinkling that into each of the chapters. You know, the first example being, of course, that black people are not offered the same protection from violence, right, and they can't count upon the police for the civic service that they are supposedly trying to provide.
Right.
We'll move on to the second chapter now, and you kind of talk about the Great Depression and the ascendancy of the Democratic Party machine.
Mm-hmm.
You basically argue that the police selectively enforce vice law in a way that ends up reinforcing Democratic Party power.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this is actually a story that transcends the Depression decade. I mean, the history of vice policing in Chicago, it's very much a history of, in a lot of contexts, white police officials knowing that, you know, you're never going to get rid of, for example, prostitution. You're never going to fully get rid of drug use. But so when they look, for example, at places where sex workers are working, what they do know is even if they can't get rid of those, they can at least get them into parts of the city that quote unquote matter less. And they're very explicit about the fact that when they're making that analysis, they're going to channel that vice into black districts. So this is a story that goes back to the late 1800s, where they literally relocate what was known as the levee, which was heavily occupied by sex workers and other forms of quote-unquote illegal behavior. They explicitly relocate that to parts of the South Side that are at that point black. And they say why they're doing it. They say, you know, this, you know, if it's in Negro districts, you know, it's less of an issue for us. And so this is something that has a kind of long history. And, you know, by the same token, during the 1920s, one of the things that people don't really think that much about, I don't believe, is that, you know, during Prohibition, a lot of gangsters, people like Al Capone, they're able to, I mean, you know, you could say what you want about Al Capone, but he's not dumb. And he's able to understand the political landscape of Chicago and know that if he, as a powerful white man, wants to set up these, in, you know, extraordinarily intricate bootlegging operations, that one way to make sure that he doesn't get disrupted very much is to set up operations in black districts because, you know, white people aren't complaining then. And so you have this history kind of playing out over and over again. During the Depression itself, you know, you have obvious human misery that afflicts basically every corner of the city. It's not confined to black Chicago, but it's heightened in black Chicago because of the ways in which, you know, racial subjugation is just has a reinforcing effect upon just kind of citywide economic crisis. So when we look at issues of evictions, issues of joblessness, issues of starvation and food insecurity, these are all things that have their most acute effects in black neighborhoods on the South Side. And so people, you know, revolt. And so part of what happens in the early 30s is that you have the city that is enforcing evictions all across the city, but especially on the South Side. So black people are being evicted from their homes relentlessly during the early 1930s. And people say enough is enough. And so what happens is that you get black activists, many of whom are affiliated with, if not formal members of the Communist Party, who essentially organize squads of people to, once an eviction has taken place, to go put the evictee's belongings back into their house. So essentially to just restore their home to how it had been before they were evicted. And because police officers are being dispatched to oversee these evictions and to provide security for these evictions, this leads to confrontations between these Black activists and police. And so you get actually massive conflict, including, I mean, you know, people being killed by the police in these moments in which you have Black activists who are really resisting police power to perform this, you know, essentially to perform austerity politics, to be the enforcers of austerity politics. And so these Black activists quite literally go to battle in the streets with city police over this issue. People die, people hang the mayor in effigy in a protest of police brutality. But you still get the sense there of what the police function actually is in that sense, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Another thing that I liked about that chapter was you kind of locate the, I don't want to say the origins of class conflict within Chicago's Black Belt, but you're talking about the Black middle class's role in these eviction battles and how, you know, different classes of Black Belt Chicago relate to the police. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, so, and to actually circle back to your observation about the first chapter, I mean, so one of the things, I mean, there's basically two through lines that are kind of, that exist throughout the book and then that exist in some ways as sort of distinct experiences that people have with the police and then eventually merge over time. And that is, on the one hand, people feeling that they are over-policed. So in other words, you know, when you're talking about anti-Black violence, that's an example of over-policing, but also, you know, just the disproportionate likelihood to be stopped for no reason on the street, to experience harassment and racism. Those are all qualities of being over-policed. On the other hand, you have people who talk about wanting better police protection. So people talk about this as, you know, feeling unsafe from white violence in the case of, you know, for example, 1919. Some people talk about it within the context of feeling scared of violence from other people within their community. But the basic premise is that, you know, for people who are talking about themselves as being underserved by the police or neglected by the police, is that the police are not doing, you know, are not, as we would say it now, serving and protecting. And so during the 1930s, this comes out in really remarkable ways because you see members, a lot of members of the Black middle class who are, I don't want to say siding with City Hall when it's inflicting these austerity politics, but you do have, so I mean, Oscar DePriest, who's one of the most famous Black politicians in the city's history, and he's really like a sort of lauded figure, but he was also a landlord, and he was one of the leading faces of this group of landlords who was trying to get the city to more aggressively enforce evictions. And so you have Black communists and Black communist affiliates who are out in the streets protesting the police when you have Black men like Oscar DePriest who are the ones not responsible for but supportive of the police being there in the first place. So you have this, you know, this class dynamic within Black Chicago. I mean, you know, obviously, I mean, no community is a monolith, right? And so you have competing interests that come through in really profound ways during that particular historic moment.
Thanks. To your point about complaints about lack of protection from white violence, that's kind of what chapter 3 gets into. And you're specifically talking about white violence in the face of integration.
Sure.
One of my favorite things about the chapter is you pull law and order, quote unquote, out of the context that we are overwhelmingly used to seeing it, which is, you know, the 70s and 80s.
Right.
And you talk about how Black activists are trying to mobilize a law and order discourse to basically affect better protection against violence.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So during the 1940s and 50s, which is where, so the chapters 3 and 4 are really, they overlap pretty heavily in terms of their chronology, but kind of explore separate issues. And so part of the story of Chicago in the 40s and 50s is that as Black people are moving to the city from the South by the hundreds of thousands, I mean, that, you know, during this time from the 1940s to the 1970s, Chicago's Black population grows by about 500,000 people. And so, as is the story in the 19-teens, when the first great migration of Black people happens to the city, they need places to live. And so, you know, Chicago is by this point in time, by the second half of the 1940s, when the Great Migration is really beginning, second Great Migration is really beginning in earnest. Chicago is very, very racially segregated already by this point, largely as a product of restrictive covenants and redlining. But that system is breaking down. I mean, that in 1948, restrictive covenants get, are rendered unenforceable by the Supreme Court, so that a lot of Black people who are looking to move into white neighborhoods and can afford to do so, they now have a legal path to do so. And this drives a lot of white folks crazy. And this is partly motivated by just outright racism. It's partly motivated by their own economic interests, because they know that once a neighborhood integrates, it becomes their property values diminish. So you have white people acting under a variety of motives, but the end result is the same, which is that they turn toward violence when they can't find legal mechanisms to prevent Black people from living near them. So from the mid-1940s to really the end of the 1950s, you have white people who are committing racial terrorism against Black people. I mean, bombing their homes, bombing cars, beating them, doing all sorts of things. I mean, like literally having riots in that number in the thousands of people to try to prevent Black people from moving in next door, from occupying city parks in white neighborhoods. It's an incredibly violent time in Chicago's history that no one really talks about. And the reason it's so important to my book is that during this moment in time, white violence is effectively decriminalized. When all of this is happening, and again, these are forms of terrorism. I mean, their purpose is, it's violence with political goals. And so when all of this is happening, the police are either actively siding with white mobs, advising them on, best ways to avoid arrest. In some cases, just refusing to arrest, as what happened in 1919. And it's something that Black people are really, really angry about, understandably, and very critical about. And it's part of this larger pattern that's happening right around mid-century, in which the idea of white criminality, the idea of people who are white being criminals, begins to lose some of its social intelligibility. Right now, I mean, Khalil Muhammad has talked at length in his own book about, where the idea of the Black criminal comes from. During the middle of the 1900s, Black arrest rates really begin to escalate in Chicago, and at the same time, white arrests begin to fall. And this is partly a product of demographic change, but it's also just the fact that police are changing who they think about as criminal. And despite the fact that they're literally standing by as white people bomb Black homes, throw rocks through Black windows, overturn Black cars, beat Black bodies, as they're literally watching these criminal acts take place, they are actively choosing to not treat that as a criminal act.
From 1945 to 1965, the CPD's budget quadrupled and the number of personnel doubled. Mm-hmm. And that just totally throws off the timeline of the punitive turn that we usually hear about, that you were discussing earlier. The roots of that buildup you locate in, I think, two coinciding phenomena, one of which is the Miriam Daly election, and the other is the response to the heroin epidemic.
Yeah. There's a variety of things that that drive this, this local punitive turn. And so you touched on a couple of them. I think the most important one to hold in hand by far is this ongoing massive influx of Black people to the city. Because that is really, in a lot of ways, what helps to shape understandings of crime and understandings of public danger and public unsafety, is that people just have a fear of proximity to Blackness. So that's one thing. But in terms of the more tangible things that you're pointing towards, Richard Daley is, I think, unquestionably the most notorious, most famous mayor in the city's history. I think that most people would say that he's probably the most consequential mayor in the city's history. He's just, you know, you can love him or hate him. I think that from my book, you probably get a sense of where I stand on him. But you can't quibble with the fact that he's a man of enormous consequence to the city's history. So when he is first elected mayor, he is up against a guy who's pretty formidable. He's up against an opponent who had been, he'd been a member of the Democratic Party. The name's Robert Merriam. And he had been a member of the Democratic Party, but he was really, really opposed to machine politics. So although him and Daley existed within the same party, they were really, really oppositional in terms of how they understood politics to be an ideal form of politics to work. So Merriam is more idealistic. He's a reformer, and he hates machine politics. So in the run-up to the 1955 election, when Daley is when Daley becomes mayor, Merriam is courted away from the Democratic Party by the Republicans. And by this point, the Republican Party, in terms of citywide offices, is essentially ineffective. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, you know, the joke in Chicago now, it's not even a joke, but I mean, the reality in Chicago now is that, you know, Republicans just in a citywide election just don't have a chance. And that was it, perhaps not to the same degree true in the middle of the 50s, but it's not far off. So the Republicans court Robert Merriam to challenge Daley as a Republican candidate. And he agrees, and he doesn't win, but he doesn't get trampled in the way that people had had expected. And part of why that is that you know, the Chicago Police Department by this point in time is so just wildly corrupt, and everyone knows it. And so Merriam really makes a big thing about this on the campaign trail. And he is constantly telling audiences, look, you cannot trust Daley to like oversee a functioning police department. And so Daley is forced to respond. And, you know, when I was down looking at, you know, Daley's papers at UIC, I mean, it's right there in his in the campaign notes where people are like, we got to do something about this issue. We've got to respond to these accusations. And so that 1955 campaign in a lot of ways becomes about law and order and becomes about the police department. And so part of Daley's pivot to responding to this challenge is to pledge to hire 2,000 more police officers to the department and to essentially just, you know, have policing in Chicago be better. And that is something that A, takes hold with voters, and B, proves to Daley and others that this is a really salient political tool and political topic. And so he keeps his word once he comes into office. He hires a ton of new police officers to the force. That does not end at that 2,000 number. I mean, he just keeps going and going and going. And then especially in and after 1960, but even during the 50s, the police power is also being radically expanded. So you're getting the rise of things like stop and frisk being put into widespread use during the 50s. And you get that applied in, you know, completely disproportionate ways in black neighborhoods. You get what's known as neighborhood saturation, where the cops just flood a neighborhood. That's being done exclusively in black neighborhoods during the 1950s, and so on and so forth. And as you rightly point out in your question, I mean, that takes money, right? I mean, so like all of these things cost money. And so the police budget is exploding during this time. And it's really important to understand that this is not wed to any sort of like spike in severe crime. The one thing, I mean, to take it to the final point from your question, I mean, the one real thing that changes in terms of criminal patterns in profound ways is the fact that there's a post-war heroin epidemic in Chicago. And while the rates of arrest really, there's no way that the rates of arrest reflect any sort of reality of who was using heroin. I mean, that, you know, I forget the exact statistic at this point, but it's, you know, it's over 90% of arrests are for drug use during the late 40s and early 50s are of black people at a time when the city is still overwhelmingly white. But so you have this heroin epidemic that once again is kind of this moment in time where the question of how a crisis is going to be addressed by the city and how the police are going to be enrolled in addressing that crisis, when that really becomes an important question. And the answer is that even though at that juncture, even though police officials themselves are saying that this is really more of a public health crisis than anything, the reality is that the city does not invest in addressing it as a public health crisis. And even though you have police officials and other people in law enforcement who are saying, look, if, you know, the best way to do this is to treat this as a medical crisis, as a public health crisis first. But if you can't do that, we're going to have to arrest these people because, you know, if you have addicts, you know, a lot of them are going to, you know, commit crimes to meet their addiction needs and, you know, et cetera. So you have this public health crisis when it hits Black neighborhoods in the late 40s and 50s that is not treated as a public health crisis, but that is instead treated as the first war on drugs in Chicago. And that's actually explicitly what it's called. It's called, you know, the Tribune calls it a war on drugs in 1950 or 1951. And even though everybody's acknowledging that this is primarily a matter of health, it's treated as a matter of crime.
Two things are really striking about what you just said, one of which is the awareness of the police, of some police, that of their power to solve social problems, mm-hmm. which is something that in my research of the 1980s and 1990s also comes up. Mm-hmm. And two, the kind of another through line of your book, or at least through line starting perhaps with the fourth chapter, is this use of police reform as a pretense for police growth and police expansion. Hmm. It seems like whenever there's a public conversation among political officials and the press about police corruption or police misconduct or malpractice or violence, the predominant solution that gets offered is more police resources. Mm-hmm.
And more police resources, I think, is the more important factor there, because it's not the more important factor. In certain contexts, it's the more important factor. The reason I say that is that for a lot of people, when they see things like police corruption, they assume that that's something that more resources will help fix. And to a certain degree, there's a logic there. I mean, the reality is that like being a police officer in the city of Chicago for a long time was, in terms of how we would define crappy jobs in terms of like good pay, was not a good job. And so a lot of police officers who were exposed for being corrupt, usually what that meant was that they were just trying to find ways to get more money. So they would work for the mob or they would do X, Y, and Z. And so there is a certain logic there that, well, if you pay police officers better, then they'll have less incentive to do these illicit things that they shouldn't be doing. But when we think about the most important problem of policing, as not one of corruption, but as issues of racism, issues of, you know, I mean, all of the various things that I would say collectively mean or collectively make up what I would call the policing crisis. I mean, whatever a lot of people would call the policing crisis that we face right now. There's just a lot of things that more resources are not necessarily going to fix, because they're not ultimately matters of resources. They're matters of ideology and matters of power.
Mm-hmm. And it also puzzles me how the problems entailed in the policing crisis that you mentioned they never fall under the rubric of corruption. No one ever you know, when people speak of police corruption, it's kind of always narrowly defined as
a single or small group of officers pursuing like additional economic gain through like informal economy or crime. And it's never expanded to include beating up black people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just incredible to me.
Yeah. There's actually, there was a city commission done at the end of the 1920s. You know, I mean, because everybody at this point knew that the police were really corrupt. But so they authored this this really, I mean, it's a book. It's not just a report. It's a 300-page book, literally called Chicago Police Problems. And nowhere do issues of racism, issues of violence, or anything like that come up. It's all just these issues of like corruption, misorganization, and so on. So I mean, yeah, these sort of reformist visions of what policing's problems are that are in need of address. For a very long time, issues of racism, police violence, you know, harassment and so on didn't even register on people's radars.
I think the epitome of that reformist impulse, too, is the subject of the next chapter, which is about Orlando Wilson.
Sure.
And you almost take like a biographical or like kind of a career biography approach of Wilson in this chapter, which I rather liked because I think that he's a complicated person that not a lot of people have written about. I mean, there's a couple books that either deal directly or indirectly with him. And he kind of exemplifies this image of a dispassionate and responsible police reformer who's going to quote unquote professionalize the police along with structures of police accountability and kind of boosting technological resources also kind of tags along with it a mandate that police can do whatever they want.
Yeah, I mean, so Orlando Wilson is he's a very interesting figure. He's by far the most important head of the police that Chicago's ever had. He was absolutely one of the I'd say during the peak of his career, he was probably one of the three most important criminologists in the entire country. You know, he was rumored to perhaps be a successor to J. Edgar Hoover to head the FBI if Hoover ever stepped down or died. We never know how that would have played out, but and to his credit, he didn't like Hoover. But you know, so he's a person of national importance. I mean, so when he was tapped to become the head of the Chicago Police in 1960, he was actually working as the dean of the School of Criminology at California Berkeley. And he had to really be courted by the city of Chicago to come leave his academic post to take over this department. I mean, he knew what he was getting into. I mean, he very much said that it might take a generation to reform the police department here in ways that it needed to. So when he is brought in, it's in the wake of this crippling scandal for the police department that hits the city newspapers right at the end of 1959, where members of the police department are implicated in being deeply involved in this robbery ring that's up on the north side called the Summerdale Scandal. And so it's such a powerful and relentless news story that it finally really makes Daley have to do something beyond just kind of like tinkering around the edges with the police department. Like there becomes a big enough demand to actually bring in somebody who's not just going to be his political lackey and is going to actually try to do something functional with the police department. So they do this national search and they actually ask Wilson to come in as just a member of the hiring committee to serve as sort of an outside advisor. And they don't find anybody that they like and they eventually offer the job to Wilson himself. He comes in and he does an extraordinary amount of things. And he, without question, is really important in terms of professionalizing the police, in terms of trying to, in terms of streamlining police operations, in terms of modernizing the police. He also very much is a believer in police accountability, where he really is strongly in favor of trying to, you know, weed out the quote unquote, you know, bad apples. But by the same token, he is also very, very much a law and order guy. And when I say law and order guy, what I mean by that is that although by all accounts, I mean, there's nothing in his, there's nothing about him that suggests that he is anything other than pretty liberal when it comes to racial issues in an abstract way. He also has absolutely no time whatsoever for structural arguments about what about why crime happens. So when he looks at arrest rates in Chicago, when he looks at crime rates in Chicago, which are obviously tethered to police behavior in a lot of ways, he sees that as a sign that Black people are a problem. And so although, again, he is at least outrightly supportive, for example, of the civil rights movement, he also, as part of this general process of modernizing the police, professionalizing the police, he also implements and formalizes really repressive police functions. Pardon me. So, for example, although his predecessor had helped to kind of put stop and frisk on the map in really racially discriminatory ways, it was a really controversial practice that no one was quite sure if it was legal or not. And so Orlando Wilson takes it upon himself to really become the most important lobbyist to the state legislature for legalizing stop and frisk. So he does things like that. He also implements quota systems for officers who work in Black districts, where they're explicitly measured in terms of their, in terms of how, quote unquote, how well they're doing their job. That's tied directly to the number of people they're stopping and questioning. And he also, I'll say two more things about him. So the first is that he is very budget conscious in the sense that he's not budget conscious. He's, I guess, the opposite of budget conscious in the sense that whatever amount of money he can get for the police department, he wants. So he's very conscious of how important a robust police budget is. So he's in a lot of ways responsible for that enormous, enormous growth of the police budget that you referred to earlier. And it's really important to understand that when he is making the arguments for that expansion of the police budget, he's using really racist ideas to structure the argument behind it. So there's this memorandum that I found in his files, which are out in Berkeley, that was from his time with the CPD, where they basically, it's an internal document from the police department, where they're making an assessment of what crime rates are going to look like over the rest of the 1960s. And so this memo, it was undated, but it's from 63 or 64. And what they do is they look at migration trends of Black people into the city. And they say, okay, well, we can expect that this many more Black people are going to arrive in the city over the rest of the 1960s. So if, say, 20%, if the Black population is going to expand by 20%, we can assume that the crime rate's going to expand by 20%. If the crime rate is going to expand by 20%, we need to ask for a 20% increase of the budget. and so you get these logics about Black people as being innately predisposed towards crime embedded in the growth of the police department, right? I mean, that's not actually, there's no way of knowing, in any sort of meaningful way. But the basic gist of what they're doing, the intellectual move they're making, is to say more Black people equals more crime, which necessitates more police. And the city buys it hook, line, and sinker. And they have extraordinary success getting a ton more resources for that, to wage this, increasingly hyper-aggressive system of what Wilson calls aggressive preventive patrol, which is essentially broken windows policing by a different name.
And you also mentioned that he, another kind of statistical maneuver that he uses to argue for growth in the police budget is that attempted crimes be recorded. Mm-hmm. I had not heard of that. And that's just mm-hmm. another example of police officials using the malleability of statistics mm-hmm. to argue that police aren't being sufficiently supported.
Right.
He also went on record and said two things that pro-police right-wingers even talk about in the same general terms today, which is One, that civil rights activism is a drain on police resources mm-hmm. and thus mm-hmm. threatens a peaceful society. Mm-hmm. And two, that limits on police power also put society in jeopardy.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, the first part of that especially, I think, is really important. Just to understand, just as a sort of citizen of this society, you know, I mean, and Wilson is not the first person to make this argument that says that black demonstrations for civil rights are untenable because police have to go respond to these, you know, respond, and then that, and then if police are responding to these civil rights initiatives, then they're not responding to other things elsewhere in the city. Therefore, those people in other parts of the city are being deprived of their rights to public safety. So you have this as an argument, you know, I mean, even in the 1940s and 50s during this this period that I talked about in which white violence is being decriminalized, despite white violence being decriminalized, the city is still dispatching a ton of police officers there. They're just not doing much once they're actually on the ground. But you have the head of the police department at that time was a man named Timothy O'Connor, who was Wilson's predecessor. And he basically said that neighborhood integration should be put on hold because the police department was being robbed of resources because it was trying to protect black people, because it had to protect black people from these white racists who didn't want them living in their neighborhood. Which, when you're talking about, you know, who has rights, it's a pretty telling statement, right, about the fact that black people who are just trying to live their life in a neighborhood, that because the police are doing their job, like, that's not considered a legitimate priority for the police to keep black people safe. So Wilson does the same thing. And the most striking example of that is in 1966. Martin Luther King spends a lot of the year 1966 in Chicago, especially during the summer, as part of an open housing campaign here. And Wilson has a fairly cordial relationship to King at first, but that changes over time because, although again, there's nothing that says that there's nothing that suggests that Wilson is not sympathetic to the idea of civil rights. He's very, very hostile to the idea that, for example, blocking traffic or marching without a permit, he's hostile to the idea that these things are legitimate. And so as the summer of 1966 escalates and as it becomes more and more tense in Chicago with all of these various marches going on, at what point Martin Luther King suggests that they march on the Dan Ryan and shut it down. And once talk of things like that escalates, Wilson goes to Daley and say, look, if these things continue, we are going to have to redirect unsustainable levels of police officers to these scenes. It's going to put the rest of the city in jeopardy. And Daley uses that argument from Wilson to issue an injunction against the civil rights movement that limits, that essentially guts their ability to do any sort of public protests, and that effectively crushes the momentum that had built over the course of the summer at that point in time. I mean, that King essentially leaves Chicago having accomplished really none of what he was hoping to do here. And in a lot of ways, the reason that he left in that fashion was because of the intellectual moves Orlando Wilson made to suggest that the things that he was doing were illegitimate.
The next chapter, you kind of open with the infamous 68 police riot at mm-hmm. the Democratic National Convention, but you kind of use it as a way to introduce, I think, what is a more kind of insidious and more interesting point, which is this transformation of the police from the political tool of the Democratic Party to a more extreme political organization in its own right. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that transformation?
Sure. Yeah, and I'll try to be brief. So a couple of things are going on there. I mean, so the way that I use the 68 DNC police riot is kind of as a foil. You know, I mean, because the 1968 DNC riot, or police riot, pardon me, it really has stood out in the kind of iconography of the 1960s as this unbelievable moment of state violence that really, like, reflects the larger 60s. The reality is that the 68 DNC police riot is important in the political history of the United States, it actually tells us very little about what state violence is really like. Because, you know, I mean, no one's killed at the 68 DNC police riot. And what police officers did there, although it was terrible, and, you know, I mean, the violence that they meted out upon, you know, primarily student age protesters was horrific. It was pretty tame compared to the realities of living under police violence and repression elsewhere in the city for Black people. And part of the reason why I talk about it in that way is that, you know, the 68 DNC riot here, police riot, is given such pride of place that people don't even think about the fact that, you know, just a few months before, a bunch of Black people were killed, a lot of them by police, in an uprising in the aftermath of Martin Luther King's assassination, you know, in which the police are, you know, are rolling around the West Side with, you know, machine guns and using them, you know. So, I mean, during the DNC, you know, there was, I mean, the artillery that was being deployed in the streets was astounding. But, you know, as a general rule, police were not, you know, just casually firing machine guns into, you know, into businesses and so on. And so that's, I use the DNC riot in that way to sort of suggest, let's pull back and think about, like, let's de-emphasize that as really something that tells us a whole lot about policing in the 1960s, in terms of how violence is operative within the police apparatus. But to your point about how it signals this larger kind of shift in police politics, by which I mean the politics of police themselves, throughout the course of the 1960s, the police are, a couple of things are happening. Police in general are becoming more and more aggrieved, partly in response to, you know, all of these clashes with civil rights activists where they look really bad, partly because of things like their battles with student anti-war protesters, in which police often look very bad. Part of it is, you know, the language and action of Black power activists. So over the course of the 1960s, a lot of police are getting increasingly angry and increasingly defensive. And this is leading them towards really, really, really reactionary politics. And this is important both in and of itself, because it's important to think about the repercussions of these public servants having really reactionary politics. But it's also important because it's during this time that police organizations that will later just become unions are gaining not just increasing power, but particular types of increasing power, by which I mean that, you know, whereas prior to the 1960s, most police organizations in Chicago, you know, things like the Patrolmen's Union and so on, it's not called the union.
Association.
Thank you. You know, part of mostly what they're doing prior to the 1960s is just doing things like, you know, trying to lobby for better pay. but at the beginning of the 1960s, really what they do is they pivot hard towards fighting against any infringement upon their supposed professional rights. So actually the Chicago Patrolmen's Association becomes the leading opponent of Orlando Wilson, actually. So the Chicago Patrolmen's Association, which represents 9,000 Chicago police officers, by the early 1960s is pretty much an open revolt against Wilson, because Wilson wants to, you know, do things like have an internal investigations division and to try to root out cops who are corrupt. And the actions of these police organizations, you know, things like the Fraternal Order of Police, they just become more and more and more aggressive and reactionary and also powerful over the course of the 60s. You know, and by the 1968 presidential election, the National Fraternal Order of Police invites George Wallace to come speak at their national convention. And as he's going off on these insane conspiracy theories about communists and about Black people and about how, you know, if the police were just allowed to run the country for a while, all its problems would be fixed. You know, as he's saying all these things, I mean, he's just getting, you know, standing ovation after standing ovation. And you also get police that are, you know, just straight up aligning with right-wing extremist groups, you know, I mean, including the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, the, you know, one of the like major news stories from the end of 1967 was the fact that the Grand Dragon of the Illinois Klan was also a Chicago police officer who was recruiting amongst his white colleagues for at least a year by the time that he was exposed. And, you know, this sort of thing is just increasingly suggestive of a very, very dangerous, I think a very dangerous turn in how police officers see themselves. You know, that they are increasingly seeing themselves as kind of partisans in this war for the soul of society. And they see their partners in this war as being, among others, some of the most reactionary elements of American society, whether people like George Wallace or organizations like the Klan, which I think is a really, really cautionary story.
Absolutely. I think the police, and there are examples from the time that you're speaking about and our present moment in which the police are kind of the most obvious overlap between mainstream conservatism and the far right. Mm. So that's very interesting. We'll wrap up shortly, but the last chapter, you get to talk about your original interest that you brought to grad school, which is the Black Panther chairman, Fred Hampton, and his assassination by Chicago Police Department, but then discuss the different ways that Black activists have, with more or less degrees of state involvement, tried to reckon with violence in their own communities, which I think is one of the most vexing questions in the carceral state literature, and something that people like Michael Chapin Fortner and James Foreman Jr. have tried to reckon with, and something that I think you discuss pretty deftly here. So could you talk about some of those competing attempts?
So in 1969, you know, Fred Hampton, who's 21 years old, is assassinated in his bed by the Chicago Police Department, in coordination with the FBI and in coordination with the Cook County State's Attorney. When that happens, it's in some ways for a lot of Black people in Chicago, and I won't say, I would say for most of Black Chicago. I mean, the Panthers were, before his assassination, were obviously a controversial presence even for a lot of Black Chicagoans, that plenty of Black Chicagoans thought that the Panthers were going too far with their rhetoric and so on, even though they very much enjoyed and appreciated the survival programs that the Panthers were putting in place, things like free breakfast for children and so on. But suffice to say that the Panthers did not have a majority share of support from the Black community prior to the entirety of the Black community before his assassination. But his assassination for a lot of people is to some degree a version of what Adam Green, who teaches at the University of Chicago, what he has called a moment of simultaneity, which is kind of this moment in time in which a particular event has a transformative impact on the kind of the consciousness and self-awareness of a group of people. And so the context in which Adam uses it is within the context of, he uses it a couple of ways, but the one that comes most to mind is in the lynching of Emmett Till, where it sort of just catalyzes, it's sort of a cohering moment in particularly for Black Chicago, but obviously for Black Americans elsewhere as well. But so what happens in the aftermath of Hampton's assassination is that so many different individuals and organizations in Black Chicago mobilize in his name. And they mobilize in all sorts of different ways, whether that be, to provide more robust relief for victims of poverty. A lot of organizations, I mean, the most pronounced way is they mobilize in his memory to challenge police authority. And, this becomes a kind of shocking wake-up call for a lot of people about the extent to which the police will go to neutralize opponents. But part of what is coming out of that milieu in the early 1970s is that you not only have organizations that are mobilizing in Fred Hampton's name to challenge and curtail this sort of out-of-control police power, but you also have other members of the community and, indeed, people who also are wanting to challenge police power who are arguing that the police are still not serving Black communities well enough. So that the police are willing to go assassinate somebody like Fred Hampton, who's doing a lot of good for the community. But by the same token, they're not doing enough to protect Black kids, you know, growing up in this city. And, you know, it's important to understand that this is also by the end of the 1960s and the early 1970s, there is a crisis of violent crime facing Black youth in this city. That was not true before the mid-1960s, but by the beginning of the 1970s, it is true. And so for a lot of community organizations, they're either saying one or both of the following: the police are out of control and just completely abusing us, repressing us, harassing us. And on the other hand, police are nowhere to be found when we need them, and they are completely abrogating their responsibilities to us as taxpayers to perform their supposed job of ensuring public safety. So what's important and interesting about the people who occupy that latter group, the people who are saying, look, the police are just not serving us as taxpayers and they should be doing more, is that it's very, very uncommon for them to hold that opinion while also saying that the police are doing a good job on the other hand, right? I mean, so that there are very few people who are saying, okay, well, the police should be doing more, but we also appreciate the way that they treat us in the everyday context of our own lives. So, and what this means is that, well, and the other thing is that they also in general are saying, look, we need more policing in our neighborhoods. We need better policing in our neighborhoods, but we also need better resources for schools, job training, you know, mental health clinics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which I think Forman in his book calls an all of the above approach, where, you know, they basically say that police are not the be all end all solution to these problems, but police can perhaps be either part of the solution or can at least be a stopgap solution pending these other more important social investments that could help eliminate these problems in the first place. So you have kind of this complex cauldron of Black politics surrounding the police in the early 1970s, a lot of which is driven out of severe outrage and grief over the assassination of Fred Hampton, but also just the numerous dozens and dozens and dozens of Black deaths at the hands of the police at the end of the 60s and early 70s, and anger over things like stop and frisk. So you have a lot of people who are talking about those sorts of things. And at the same time, you have a lot of people who are just saying the police are not doing enough to keep us safe. But the one common thread that kind of binds them all together, even though they might seem competing at first blush, is the fact that what they all share is an acknowledgement that the police just don't work well for them.
I think a lot of the questions that both of those parties asked were left unresolved in the 70s. You kind of connect those questions to the policing crisis that you mentioned earlier that we are currently embroiled in.
Right. I think that the most compelling thing I think that comes out of that conversation that's happening in the early 1970s is the campaign for community control of the police, which originates with what's left of the Black Panther Party, but it also weaves together this patchwork fabric of community organizations from all sorts of racial and ethnic and religious backgrounds from all across the city of Chicago in the early 1970s to basically try to establish a movement to get community control of the police, which essentially means that rather than there being a Chicago Police Department, there would really essentially be like an Englewood Police Department, and the citizens of Englewood would decide what policing should look like in that neighborhood, and the same thing for, you know, uptown and so on. So basically that specific neighborhoods are able to determine what their needs over public safety are, rather than say somebody who occupies City Hall and who lives in Hyde Park or who lives in, you know, the Gold Coast or something that has no real connection to say North Lawndale or to Englewood, that person at City Hall, that City Hall bureaucrat who doesn't have any idea about the lived experiences of people who live in those neighborhoods, that they actually get to determine what policing looks like. And that would include hiring power, firing power, and so on. And so the Panthers lead this charge to try to get this community control initiative on the ballot in the early 70s. And it ultimately fails, but it's one way to conceive of how the conversations that you and I are talking about right now, how they could potentially be resolved, right? I mean, that, you know, that perhaps if you take the policing mission even more localized than this gigantic space that, you know, is defined by city limits, and instead think about it more as a neighborhood enterprise that is able to be more nimble and responsive, perhaps, and more, and importantly, more accountable. That perhaps that is the way to, some way to go about resolving these questions. Because we really haven't, we don't have a historical example of this in action, really. Who knows? And I think that probably a lot of people who do fall into that abolitionist wing of politics would say that that's probably, you know, you're probably still going to see those same problems just replicated just at a smaller scale. Mm-hmm. So who knows? But I mean, I do think that that is, that that's that's really the moment that I end the book on, and before the epilogue, is talking about that movement as perhaps one way to think about how this could play out differently.
I think offering answers to these questions would be perhaps a little bit harder than
sure.
problems you tackle in the book.
Right.
But in any case, I want to thank you for writing such an interesting and important book.
Thank
and
you.
I think one that points us in the right direction as far as questions we need to ask ourselves about the study of cities and the study of municipal politics mm-hmm. and also the future of organizing in Chicago and elsewhere.
Sure.
Before I let you go, I'd like to hear about your next project or what you're working on now.
Sure. Yeah, I'm juggling two projects. The first of which, and you alluded to this, I went into graduate school wanting to do a biography of Fred Hampton. And I ultimately wrote this book, and I wrote the dissertation version of what became this book instead of that. And so one of the things that I'm doing right now is turning back towards doing that true biography. There's been some fantastic scholarship and fantastic stuff written about Hampton. Jacoby Williams wrote a book about the Illinois Panthers. The lawyer for Fred Hampton's family, Jeff Haas, wrote a memoir about the trial of the people who killed him, and you know, that took place here in Chicago, obviously. But I still think that this is a life that is deserving of just its own kind of focused look and analysis. And so that's the big book project I'm doing right now, and I've been making, I would say, quite a bit of headway with it this summer, which has been nice. And then the other project is one that I'm really excited about, but I'm trying to figure out if it's just an article or if it's going to be a book. But it's about the history of white people donning blackface to commit crimes, which I have found a pretty remarkable historic trail about, you know, primarily during the Jim Crow era. And it says a lot of fascinating things about, you know, about criminalization, about racial violence, because a lot of people are talking about how this puts black people at risk of lynching when, you know, if a crime is committed and black people are suspected, when it was actually a white person who did it. I think that it collides, it sort of represents a collision of the literature on blackface and racial perception with, you know, this literature on the carceral state, you know, what Khalil has called the condemnation of blackness and so on. So, I mean, they're two wildly different projects that I'm passionate about both of them. One is definitely going to be a book. The other, I'm still figuring out what form it'll take.
Well, I look forward to reading both of those.
Cool, so thank you.
Thanks for sitting down.
Yeah, thank you.